Okay, we are in Hebrews chapter 10. We're going to finish chapter 10 and see how much we can progress into chapter 11. It's been 3 weeks since we've been together for our class with the gospel meeting. We took a little break from our class, and so what I want to do is try to pick up where we left off last time, do a little bit of review to catch us up to the point where we stopped, and then proceed from there. Book of Hebrews is an exciting book to study. You learn a lot about God's scheme of redemption. You learn a lot about God's overall plan to save man. You learn a lot about the relationship between the Old Testament and the New Testament, about the coming of Christ. And obviously his major theme is the superiority of Christ, presenting Christ to be better than anything that Judaism ever had to offer, that he's better than the prophets, he's better than the angels, that he has, he's better than Moses and Joshua with a better rest, better priesthood, also everything you go through there, 13 chapters, and you find that word better 13 times. And so he spends a lot of time presenting argumentation to these individuals who had converted out of Judaism, had converted to Christ, and yet because of a variety of circumstances were on the verge of returning back to their old ways. And the writer is pleading with them to remain faithful unto Christ and urges them to know that there's no way that that they can have an eternal reward from God if they turn their back on Jesus Christ. And so we have spent time looking at the first 9.5 chapters of the book, which are really the major doctrinal section of this book, as he is over and over been presenting Christ as superior in every way. And then you get to chapter 10 and verse 19. And starting in chapter 10 and verse 19, you begin what is often called the practical section of this book. Doesn't mean that there hasn't been anything practical in the first section. There has been. And it doesn't mean that there won't be anything doctrinal in the second section of this book. There will be. But by and large, you start in chapter 10 and verse 19, and he's getting right down into a direct and immediate application for these Christians. Now, think about who he's writing to. He's writing to a group of Christians converted out of Judaism, but they are on the verge of turning their backs on Christ and going back into Judaism. He's not writing to people who have already fallen away. If he was going to write a letter to those who had fallen away, he would have to address an individual letter to an individual person to get him to come back. He is addressing a group of people. He has to be able to send that to a central location, obviously to a church, to encourage them. And so these people are on the verge. They're nearly ready to go back, a large group of them. But he's urging them to remain where they are in their steadfast devotion to Christ and holding on to him. And so when we get to chapter 10 and verse 19, in a very great and exciting way, he talks about what the Christian life is all about, presents the Christian life as being superior in every way, and begins to make these applications. We noted last time that in the verse 22, first two words of verse 22, let us, first two words of verse 23, let us, first three words of verse 24, and let us, that little phrase, again, is one of the key phrases in the book. 13 chapters in the book, 13 times we see those two little words, let us together. So it's not just a doctrinal book to present Christ as better and superior. It is a practical book where he says, let us go on to perfection. Let us grow. Let us hold fast to our confession. And so starting in verse 19, he has two conclusions that he's going to draw his exhortations out of. First is in verse 19 that he said, we have boldness to enter into the presence of God, to the holiest. We have that ability because of the blood of Jesus. Jesus gave us access to God. That's a key to this book. The Jews didn't have direct access to God. Christians do because of the blood of Christ. Second thing he says in verse 21 is that we've got a great priest. We not only have access to God, we have a great priest who is there, who is pleading our case and standing before God making intercession for us. And so he says, what do we need to do, verse 22? We need to draw near to God. Let us draw near to God. What do we need to do in verse 23? Let us hold fast the confession of the hope that we have and do it without wavering. And those two things you might consider as a personal responsibility. I have a personal responsibility for me to draw near to God. I have a personal responsibility for me to hold fast to my confession. But then you get to verse 24, and he says, don't just look at this as a personal responsibility. He says in verse 24, and let us consider one another. Here's a group of Christians who needed each other. They needed each other so much, he says, you need to consider one another how you might stir up love and good works. They needed each other to encourage and help each other in their service to the Lord. And so he says in verse 25, how do we go about doing that? What is one method that we have? What is one means we have by which we can encourage each other? We assemble together. And when we assemble together, one of the great things about assembling together is that we are able to encourage one another. We are able, in this assembly, we're able to do in assemblies with Christians things that we cannot do outside of the assembly. Now, that's not to say we can't encourage one another else that we do. But there is a unique way that we encourage one another in the assembly that cannot be done outside. When you come together with a group of Christians and you assemble to praise God together, you can't have that. You can't have that outside of your assembly. You come together and there's something about being together. This was something these Christians needed to be reminded of, is that assembling together was one of the greatest blessings that they had. And they didn't need to forsake it. Here's that verse in the Bible, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together, as is the manner of some, but exhorting one another daily, and so much the more as you see the day approaching. So the idea there is that these individuals, again, were on the verge of falling away, but they hadn't done it yet. And so they were not forsaking the assembly because they had fallen away. That's a whole different line of thinking. They were not forsaking the assembly because they had fallen away. He's urging them, don't fall away by forsaking the assembly. Is there a connection? Is there a connection between somebody's faith, their devotion, their faithfulness to God, and their presence in the assembly of the Lord, of the church? Is there a connection? Certainly. There's absolutely a connection. And what often happens is that sometimes the first sign, visible sign that we see that somebody's struggling with their faith, visibly we don't see them here. So what is our responsibility? Consider them in order to stir up love and good works and make sure that they are staying faithful to the assembly. Well, what if somebody isn't staying faithful to the assembly? What does verse 26 and following talk about? If we sin willfully, that would include the assembly, but it would include all manner in which someone gets habitually involved in a sin. If we sin willfully, after we've come to a knowledge of the truth, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sins. What remains? Certain fearful expectation of judgment. What remains? A fiery indignation that's going to devour the adversaries. And so he goes in this section, verse 26 through 31, is one of his major exhortations where he is warning them about the danger of falling away. What if you fall away, you don't have sacrifice for sins anymore. If you fall away, you've got a fearful expectation of judgment. If you fall away, verse 29, you can expect a much worse punishment. If we fall away, verse 30, we can expect the vengeance of God. If we fall away, verse 31, we fall into the hands of the living God. Don't want any part of any of that, do we? That's a part of him warning them, here's the direction that you are headed if you turn your back on Christ. And so he's pleading with them, you receive the knowledge of the truth, stay faithful to it, stay true to it, and don't turn your back on what God has given to you. Come down to verse 32. What's the first word you have in verse 32? But. Everybody got that word? What is that? That's a word of contrast. Go back to chapter 6 for just a second. Go back to chapter 6 and verse 9. Tell me what the first word you have in chapter 6 and verse 9 is. Hopefully it's the same. But. Now, those aren't the only two verses, obviously, in the book that do this. But there is a similarity between what you have in chapter 6 and verse 9, where he starts that verse with the word but, and what you have in chapter 10 and verse 32, where he starts that verse with the word but. You might remember back in chapter 6, he was telling them and warning them, look, you are on the verge of falling away from Christ to the point that you cannot return unless you make some serious changes. But, he said in verse 29, or chapter 6 and verse 9, he said, but we have faith, we have hope of great things for you. That's what he's doing here in verse 32 of chapter 10. He has just given them one of the sternest warnings in the book, chapter 10, verses 26 through 31. He'd even told them that if you turn your back on Jesus, you're trampling him underfoot. You're looking at his blood and saying, big deal, who cares if he shed his blood? This is serious. But then he gets to verse 32, but, and he turns a corner here and calls for their continued faithfulness and their continued endurance. Look at what he says. He says, but recall the former days. Think about the good old days. Recall the former days in which after you were illuminated. Anybody have anything different than illuminated? Enlightened? What is this talking about? This is when they were converted. That's all. When someone turns from darkness to light, what is that called? They're converted. That's when they become a Christian. So he says, recall the former days in which, after you became a Christian, what happened? You endured. They became Christians, and what apparently happened very soon thereafter? Persecution. A great struggle with sufferings. Word struggle there comes from the Greek word that we get athletics from. They were involved in a constant struggle, in a constant battle and conflict. Now, if you had become a Christian, and right after you become a Christian, you endure a great struggle, is that going to shake you? Is that going to bother you? Is that going to make you question some things? Look at what he says in verse 32. What happened? Notice the word partly. At least in the King James in verse 33, you got the word partly twice saying, Here's what happened in this struggle. Part of the struggle, partly while you were made a spectacle, both by reproaches and tribulations. Partly while you were made a spectacle. Anybody have a different word than the word spectacle? Say again. You were made a gazing stock. That's an interesting, you were made a gazing stock. What else you got? Somebody else have a different translation? The word here for gazing stock, the word here for spectacle, is the word that we get the word theater from. They were made a theatrical display in their sufferings. So it was not that they were being persecuted behind closed doors necessarily. It was not that, you know, they were being persecuted in ways that nobody really knew about. It was just kind of a private matter, private messages that were going on. This was a public display. And we'll see a little later on, we get to chapter 11, some of the things that others had endured. But this was something that was very obvious that they had endured. Now, that was part of it. The struggle, the sufferings they had, partly was because they were made a spectacle by reproaches and trauma, tribulation. The other part of their suffering was they had become companions of those who were so treated. And so they were being mistreated, they were being persecuted, and they were also friends with other Christians who were being persecuted. And when our brethren weep, what do? We weep. When they hurt, what do? We hurt. That's the nature of the body. And so they were being persecuted individually, they saw their brethren being persecuted, and they thought that all of us together are suffering a great suffering here. Verse 34? For you had compassion on me, or some translations say on the prisoners. You had compassion on the prisoners in their chains, and joyfully, how did they do this? Joyfully accepted the plundering of your goods. So I want you to imagine you become a Christian. You endure great persecution through some public display, public spectacle, where you are persecuted in a very obvious, grotesque way. And your friends are, your Christian friends are going through the same thing. And then verse 34 says, while you're going through this, you're trying to help out the prisoners. Apparently, some Christians who had been put in prison. Now imagine back then, when they were put in prison, they didn't get three squares a day. They didn't get cable. They didn't get a workroom. They didn't get AC. They didn't get all of the... If you're in prison back then, you don't get food. You got to have somebody outside caring for you. The state's not taking care of you. They're locking you up. So here's a Christian who's put in prison. Who's going to take care of him? I mean, when Jesus talks about in Matthew 25, being in prison and you took care of me, that's not just you go to prison and you pick up the phone on one side of the glass and he picks up the phone on the other. How you doing today? Not picking up the phone and talking. It is, they don't have anything. How are they going to clean themselves? How are they going to eat? You got to take care of them. So all the while I'm being persecuted, these folks in prison, I'm trying to take care of them. And then what's happening is my house is being invaded and my possessions, my belongings are being taken. And he says, you endured it joyfully. Now, what kind of person can endure that joyfully? Somebody, what does the rest of the verse say? The Bible tells us how you endure that joyfully. The rest of verse 34, you endured it joyfully, the plenty of your goods, knowing that you have a better and an enduring possession for yourselves in heaven. Had they laid up their treasures on earth? Not where their treasures were. They laid up their treasures in heaven. And so when bad things were happening to their things on earth, where was their focus? Oh, their citizenship, and you're going to see this all throughout these next verses in the next chapters. Their citizenship was in heaven. So he spends verses, 32 through 34, calling them to endure what they were going through and reminds them, here's where you have been. And then verse 35, he says, okay, we need to keep going. We don't need to stop. Therefore, verse 35, do not throw away, do not cast away your confidence, because that has great reward. For you have need of endurance, so that after you have done the will of God, you may receive the promise. Notice in these verses, verse 34, the enduring possession. Verse 35, the great reward. Verse 36, the promise of God. This whole section is about keep your eye on the goal. Keep your eye on the goal of heaven. For yet a little while, and he who is coming will come. He will not tarry. Now the just shall live by faith. I think sometimes we misunderstand what that means. This is a quotation from the book of Habakkuk. And we read that statement throughout the New Testament, the just shall live by faith. And because of the order of the words, we think it means if I am a righteous person, if I'm a Christian, I am going to live here on this earth by faith. But that's not what this, the verb tenses don't allow that. This isn't talking about you be a Christian here, and as a Christian, you live your life according to faith. And because of the word order, we think that. What he is saying is the righteous, the just people, they shall live in heaven. This is eternal living. And especially when you put in this context where he talks about that eternal possession, the great reward and the promise, he's talking about the righteous shall live. Now, how are they going to do that? How are they going to live eternally? By living according to faith here. You put your faith in God here, and what's your promise? You're going to live. You're going to live eternally. But what do you have after that? Now, verse 38. Now, the just shall live by faith. What's the next word you have after that? You with me in verse 38? You got the word but again? What happens? Just shall live by faith, but if anyone draws back, my soul has no pleasure in him. Is it possible for a Christian to fall away? Is that possible? Is it possible for a Christian to draw back from God, from his faith, and to so live that he could lose that promise? The doctrine of once saved, always saved does not find any sympathy in the book of Hebrews. The entirety of the book teaches against that doctrine. And here is a great section to emphasize that if we want to live eternally, we've got to live by faith, but it is possible for somebody to draw back. And if somebody does so, God has no pleasure in him. But in verse 39, but we, Christians, we are not of those who, different translations have different words here. We are not of those who do what? Draw back. Shrink back. Anybody got anything else? We are not of those. Draw back has a certain imagery. We are not of those who shrink back. That has another. What do you think of when you hear that idea? We are not of those who that shrink back. What are we doing as Christians? Pressing forward. What happens when persecution comes? Well, we want to back off. We want to draw back and shrink underneath the pressure of that persecution. And what does he say? That's not us. As Christians, we've got to press forward and not draw back, because where does drawing back lead you? We are not of those who draw back to what? Perdition? Destruction? What happens if a Christian falls away? It leads to perdition, to destruction. But we are of those. Now, if you've got a King James or New King James, I think your translation here at the end of verse 39 is going to say, but we are of those who believe. You have the word believe, King James, New King James, you got the word believe. And it's the same thing. It's saying the same thing. But if you've got a New American Standard, American Standard, ESV, I don't think you have the word believe there, do you? But of those who have faith. Now, obviously it's saying the same thing. Those who believe, those who have faith is the same thing. But what is chapter 11 about? What is Hebrews chapter 11 about? Faith. What does he do? Hebrews chapter 11 is not just in isolation somewhere by itself, and it has nothing to do with what's surrounding it. Hebrews chapter 11 is strategically placed there, but what he's leading right into it. How will people live eternally? They're going to live here on earth by faith. But we're not of those who draw back, because we are of those who have faith to the saving of the soul. What's the interesting word? Chapter 11, verse 1. What's the first word you have in chapter 11, verse 1? Now? Now what? Why does it start? Why does that chapter start with the word now? He's not saying now as opposed to this is different than it was 1,000 years ago. He's not talking about in time. He's not saying now, then this is different than it will be 1,000 years from now. It's not a chronological necessarily now. Why would he start with now? I think he's using that as a defining word. We are not of those who draw back to perdition, but of those who have faith to the saving of the soul. Now, let me talk to you about faith. I think that's why you use the word now. Now that I've mentioned faith, let me give you 40 verses about faith. And here is a book that you could say the whole book of Hebrews. You could say the whole book of Hebrews is about faith. Here's a book that is urging these Christians to live faithfully to God, not turn away from their faith, to make sure that they are growing in their faith. The whole book is centered on their faith. But we get to chapter 11, and sometimes we just automatically, we strategically place it, well, that's the hall of faith, or the hall of fame of God's faithful. But it does have a context. And the context here is that God is talking to some of his people, and he's saying, do not turn back. Pleading with you. You have need of endurance. What verse was that in chapter 10? You have need of endurance. Was that verse 36 or verse 35? Verse 36. You have need of endurance, of perseverance. Don't stop. And then what does he do? He goes back to some of their heroes. And he's going to talk to them about their heroes. Their heroes of the Old Testament. Their heroes that they had grown up knowing about. These weren't strangers to them. They knew all about them. But he's going to say, let me tell you about them. And I want you to see what they did and what they had. But as you go through chapter 11, he's also going to say, let me show you how much better we have it as Christians. Now, faith. Different translations do different things with verse 1. Now, faith is the, what word do you have? Substance. Assurance. But you got anything different? That's it. It is, faith is the substance. It is the assurance of what? Things not seen. I want you to remember that. Things not seen. Because as you go through chapter 11 and part of chapter 12, he's going to talk about, especially in chapter 11, things that the old faithful ones of the Old Testament did, but they never saw what was happening. They couldn't see it. Couldn't see the promise. Couldn't see where they were going. Abraham left his hometown. Where was he going? Don't know. What is faith? Faith is the assurance of things not seen. What caused Abraham to leave his home and go somewhere where he could not see where he was going? Faith. I don't know who to blame, the world or ourselves. We've got this idea that faith is just some kind of a wishy-washy, you know, feeling that you have, or it's for those who are weak-minded. You know, if you have faith in God, well, it's just because you're not strong enough to make it through life without faith in God. That's your crutch, is your belief. The world has just so manipulated that word. Now, this is not necessarily a definition. It's more a description of what faith is. But faith is full assurance about things that are hoped for. Things that are yet in the future. And I've got assurance of them. How do you know? Mickey? Yeah. The second part of this, faith is the substance or the assurance of things hoped for, the evidence, conviction, or proof. What is faith? Is faith a leap in the dark? I don't know where I'm going. I figure this is about okay. You know, she believes it, he believes it. If they believe it, it's okay for me. What's faith? The evidence, the assurance, the proof of things not seen. What? How can you have faith in something that's not seen? Dirk, you had your hand up. Go ahead. Say again. Yes. The first word on assurance is like a foundation. The term there is often used in a foundational sense. So it gives you a foundation, but then faith also gives you evidence. It gives you a proof in order that you might have a conviction about things that you cannot even see. Now, how is that true? And what he's going to do in these next two verses is what I want to ask you. How do you know that God created the world? Were you there? Did you see it? Did you see on that fourth day? Did you see all of a sudden a sun and moon and stars appear? Did you see that? Did you see the third day the rose come up and the tulip come up? Did you see it? And how do you know it happened? Have you just been brainwashed into believing that happened? Say it again. Wait a minute. I just asked you if you've been brainwashed. And you said yes. That was not really, Jacadi, you can't answer questions anymore if that's, no. Okay. Do you believe that there was a guy named Christopher Columbus? Did you meet him? Did you talk to him? Sailed the ocean blue in 1492. You've heard that too, right? 1490. Were you there? How old were you in 1492? Okay. Not happening. Do you believe that there was a guy named George Washington? I mean, what is that based upon? Evidence exists. Somebody says, "Yeah, but that's historical evidence, and we've got proof for that." Let me ask you a question: is there evidence? Is there proof for God? Yes. Those things that, well, look in verse 3. Come back to verse 2 in a second. Look at verse 3. By faith, we understand. And some people think those two words, faith and understand, are just completely opposed to each other, because they think faith is just this feeling you have inside, and understanding is something that's intellectual. And God, what does He do in this verse? Puts them together. By faith, we understand that the worlds were framed by the Word of God. He spoke, and it was so. So that the things which are seen were not made of things which are visible. Well, that's a negative. Things which are seen were not things made by things that are visible. So what does that mean? In a positive sense, what does that mean? The things that are seen were made by things that are not visible. In Romans chapter 1 and verse 20, he would talk about God's invisible attributes are clearly seen. Huh? If they're invisible, how can they be clearly seen? His invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, so that man, when he looks at creation, is without excuse. Romans 1 and verse 20. Man is without excuse because God has supplied the evidence. What is faith? The substance, the full assurance of things hoped for. Can you believe that when God says something, when He makes a promise, can you believe He's going to do it? Yes. And He's about ready to give us example after example after example to prove it. Can you have faith as the substance of things hoped for, the evidence, the proof, the assurance of things not seen, the confidence of things not seen? Thus, not seen would refer to things past, present, future. Can I have assurance, conviction, evidence for those? Absolutely. Faith is not some leap in the dark. And so he says, for by faith, verse 2, by faith, what he's doing in these first six, and you could even say seven verses, what he's doing in these first six verses is laying a foundation about faith. And everything he says about, we just read about, and elders, by the way, in verse 2, is not Joe and Johnny and Jerry and Dan and Phil. Anybody got a different word than the word elders in verse 2? Men of old. And it's not saying old men either, okay? And it's not saying old men as opposed to, well, old women were just left out. This is talking about people of ancient day, of days gone by. So it's not talking about elders in the church, just talking about those individuals who have lived before. What did they live by? For by faith they obtained a good testimony. Can you obtain a good testimony with God without faith? No, you can't do it. Look at verse, and so he describes this matter of faith, and then starting in verse 4, you know this, starting in verse 4, what he does is he starts presenting case after case of his hall of fame or hall of faith here of people who lived by faith. Now, we talked about once saved, always saved a moment ago. What about the doctrine of faith only? The doctrine of salvation by faith only. Very common, prevalent teaching today in the denominational world. And for them, Hebrews chapter 11, they use Hebrews chapter 11 as one of their sugar sticks. They see this whole chapter on belief. They see this whole chapter on faith, and they say, there you go. Abraham, Moses, Noah, saved by faith. That's true. If you say it that way, does the Bible say those men were saved by faith? Yes. Does the Bible say those men were saved by faith alone? Oh, that's saying it a different way. When you put that word alone or that word only on there, that's saying it a whole different way. Because when you read about these individuals, what do you notice as you read through? It'll start verse 4 by faith, verse 5 by faith, verse 7 by faith. It's going to start by faith, and then it's going to have their name. And then what does it do after their name? Tells you what they did. It tells you what their faith did. How were they justified in the eyes of God? By having some feeling inside? By having some affection towards God? Having some thanksgiving towards God for what He had done? No, it was not just some mental assent that they had. These were individuals where their faith was coupled with their obedience. And so we understand that their faith here is not talking about just some idea that they believe something in their heart, but that faith moved them to action, and that's when they were justified in the eyes of God. Look at verse 4. By faith, Abel did something. There's an action verb after it. By faith, Abel offered to God a more excellent sacrifice than Cain. Now, the rest of that verse in verse 4 could really be applied to all of the other faithful in this chapter. It's not saying that this is only for Abel. I believe he's laying some groundwork in these first 6 or 7 verses to say, here's something that applies to these men, but it applies to all of the men in this chapter, and it applies to us too. So what did Abel obtain? By faith, when his faith was moved to action, he had an obedient faith, he obtained witness from God that he was righteous. God said he was righteous. Well, wouldn't that apply to everybody who puts faith into action? And through it, he being dead still speaks. Well, does that mean that Abel's faith is the only one that still speaks? No, that could be applied to every single one of these. What happens to those who live by faith? While they might be gone, their example lives on. We'll see that again when we get to chapter 13. Verse 5, by faith Enoch was taken away so that he did not see death. One of the two men in the Bible who did not die. And he was not found because God had taken him. For, and here's something that could be applied to every person who lives by faith. For before he was taken, he had this testimony that he pleased God. Do we need to please God? Yeah. Do we need to walk by faith? Yes. And so he gives this description in verse 6. Without faith, Enoch could not have pleased God. It would have been impossible for Enoch to please God. But verse 5 says he pleased God, so he must have lived by faith. Without faith, it's impossible for anybody to please God. For anybody who wants to draw near to God. And New King James, King James has the word comes to God. And I think, are there other translations that say draw near to God in verse 6? That's the key. Draw near is one of the keys to this book to unlock it. What did Jesus provide for us? Access to God. You want that access? You want to draw near to God? He says you've got to believe. You've got to believe that He is. You've got to believe that He is a rewarder of those who diligently seek Him. By faith, Noah, being divinely warned of things not yet seen, he moved with godly fear, prepared an ark for the saving of his household, by which he condemned the world and became heir of righteousness, which is according to faith. Think about the definition of faith, the description of faith. Faith is the substance of things hoped for, evidence of things not seen. What made Noah build that ark? Was it something he saw? Was there some visual warning? Yeah, the waters are getting higher. We better get ready for this. Was there some visual reason? Some stimuli outside of himself in a physical, tangible world that says, you better go build an ark. Nope. Why did he build an ark? Because God told him to. And he had faith in God, and he put that faith into practice, into action. And when he did, he saved himself and his house, and only those 8 people were saved. We won't have time next week to look at everything in chapter 11. I know you're familiar with this chapter. I would encourage you to read through it this week. He presents a number of the faithful from the Old Testament. We'll spend a few minutes next week looking at just some sections of that. And then we've got to get into chapter 12 next week. It's an incredible book, and I hope it will help us to make that application that he wanted those readers to make, to grow, to hold on to our faith, to not give up on our faith, to make sure that we don't allow the world to get us distracted from where we need to be focused on that eternal reward. Pearl, do you have your hand up?
Yes.
What were you going to say? Bell hadn't rung. We can keep going. Yeah. Yes.
He would remember their sins.
Remember their sins no more.
Now, that does apply to us.
You better believe it. That's talking about us. That's talking about us. A lot of times we do make mistakes. Well, let's put it that way.
Yeah. And then
he gave us that promise.
And he said, I will not remember their sins.
Isn't that nice? He doesn't remember him. He doesn't remember him. Thank you all for being here. Thank you for your good attention tonight.